Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
He's back.
Yeah, back from Canada.
You bring any maple syrup?
No.
Yeah,
no, I didn't.
I was kind of disappointed that you didn't show up with maple syrup candies, and my girlfriend said, "Oh, darn, we should have asked him to bring back maple syrup."
You know, I did say, if you want anything, I can pick it up, and then you told me something about Netrunner.
Right, right.
And not even Netrunner cards, but, like, Netrunner bling.
Right, because I have all the cards, so I don't need more cards.
Right.
What kind of bling do you have for Netrunner?
Click trackers, card sleeves, that's about it.
Cool. I don't actually mean cool, but cool.
All right. So in addition to releasing Dungeons & Dragons Basic as a free PDF, today we learned that Dungeons & Dragons is planning to release some digital tools to go along with D&D 5th Edition, which is just pretty much being called D&D. So similar to what they had for 4th Edition, they said they are going to have some digital tools that combine rules, character sheets, and adventures. And the goal is to create some tools for the Dungeon Master and players to allow for fast, easy management of their game.
Hmm.
Currently, there's nothing for us to look at other than a login screen, but the code name for this program is called Morningstar.
No, code name Morningstar.
All right,
Codename Morningstar.com.
That's funny. The code name for this is Codename Morningstar.
Right.
Code name's part of the code name? Yes.
Yes.
All right. I'm not holding my breath for anything, since a lot of stuff, or I don't know how much, a lot, but some stuff didn't materialize for 4th edition, so.
Yeah, the adventure toolkit never showed up.
Right.
I was happy with the tools for 4E, because character creation in 4E was pretty complicated with all the different kinds of feats and everything. There's like 1,000 different feats and such, so. And it worked well. It was on Silverlight, which was a travesty, but, you know, hey, whatever. So, yeah, I'd imagine these are pretty simple because it's, you know, it's basically the same system. It's just changing a few of the options. I would be surprised if they didn't use the same program and just give it a new face.
Oh, they might, to save time.
But, I mean, yeah, again, it was a fine program, so.
I think I only used the digital tools or the character builder for 4th edition once.
Mm-hmm. But it's nice because you can play around and it does all the math and everything for you, so it's a real cinch to just throw together a character just for fun to see what it might be like. So, yay. Go Watsy.
Well, I guess they kind of had to do it anyway because they had it for 4E.
Right, right.
And there's already things like Roll20 out, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, they never got their virtual table like Roll20 up off the ground, did they?
I don't believe so. No.
No, I think that was the thing that was most exciting the players because even when 4E first came out, companies like GURPS did have software to make your characters and you could download the software, so.
Right, or it came in a CD in the back of the book.
Yeah, that's right.
You're speaking of virtual tabletops, I kind of wonder, I kind of know the answer, but I wonder why WotC wouldn't just say, third-party stuff already exists, we'll just make something official that people can use to run it, or that, I don't know, like a dedicated server, some kind of premium thing, rather than building their own tools.
Yeah, and Roll20 is such a great program. I've got no complaints about it at all. I just put an extra CSS file in there so that it looks more D&D-ish. And,
Sorry, what did you say? You said, why would they make their own?
Yeah, I mean, like, if they're...
Because they can make money off it and direct traffic to the sites that they support.
Well, I don't know coding or programming or anything, but I would imagine that they could set it up where, you know, if you were running a D&D game on something like Roll20, it would only have D&D ads, or you could set up some kind of, like, service where you have access to certain things if you pay. I mean, I know the answer is because it looks better if they make their own, but...
Well, and also, usually you have to sign up to make an account to it, and having that many people on a mailing list is valuable for their own marketing demographic purposes and everything like that.
True.
They're probably shy about incorporating a lot of stuff from other publishers. I do know that, well, they are having somebody produce adventures for them, but it's very much branded as a D&D adventure as opposed to, like, OGL.
Right, right.
Because now their biggest competitor is Pathfinder.
Right.
From two rule sets ago.
Right.
Yeah.
When the free version of D&D was announced, a lot of people were curious about what the OGL or what that would look like. And there were a few vague answers, but somebody noted that the wording didn't include publish. It said it would allow you to create and share third-party stuff. So people are wondering if they're not allowing people to publish. And they also said that it's going to materialize about a year after the official rollout of D&D 5th edition, which from a marketing standpoint, yeah, is incredibly smart because you don't want people competing with your products as soon as you release it.
Sorry, the license is coming out a year afterward?
Yes. So whatever the equivalent of the OGL would be for 5th edition, there was, you know, kind of vague wording of we're working on it, but we probably won't see it until a year after stuff releases for us to get it right. And fair enough, they want to get it right, but you're also thinking you also don't want any competition. And I guess I can't really blame them.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, speaking of rolling out D&D, we've been getting previews of what's going to be in the starter box. The one just today was a whole page of gear. But previous, we had a pretty large full-color piece of artwork that's going to go in the front of the How to Play section. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is going to be a bit of a rant, but I couldn't help but notice that out of the six party members, none of them were non-white. Okay, so out of a group of six PCs, two were female, and I think you had like an elf, a halfling, and a dwarf. So on the one hand, yeah, okay, they have the air quote racial diversity, but not the racial
the actual
diversity.
Racial diversity.
Right. So on top of that, personally, I didn't think it was that great of a picture. It's not very.
I thought it was a fine picture.
It's okay, but it's kind of what we said about 13th Age, where it doesn't really tell a story, it doesn't really draw me in. It's just kind of these six characters lounging around, and fair enough, it looks nice, but doesn't really tell me anything.
Talking about a picture no one can see.
All right. Hey,
if we put it in the show notes, they could.
They could see it. You know what? If they care about D&D, they've seen it already.
Right.
Or in your case, if they don't, they have.
Right.
Well, I guess they're limited in the color in that the dwarves and elves are white.
Halflings, too.
Oh, halflings as well. So that reduces them down to, what, three? Three people?
Right.
So I suppose they could have made one Asian and one black. Yeah. I mean, I'm not fussed, but I suppose putting a bit of diversity in the pictures is the easiest way.
Yeah. So
it doesn't hurt to do it, but I mean, are we at the stage? I mean, if you're going to be truly colorblind, you're not going to notice that.
Mm.
You're going to go, hey, this is the best piece of art that they had, or the most appropriate piece of art that they had for this. So that's the one that they wanted to use. And it doesn't matter what colors they are because it all balances out in the end, or, you know, we're colorblind.
Right.
But, you know.
I do not think we as a society are at that point yet. So.
No, obviously not, because people go crazy on Twitter. So.
Now, you know, honestly, I don't really think that it even crossed anybody's mind. I reckon whoever the artist was, they got a prompt to say, draw some adventurers around a campfire, and they drew, you know, the kind of image that they grew up with.
When they were adventurers around the
campfire. Right, when they were adventurers, yeah. I remember exactly. Back in the days when I was a dwarf. Yeah. No, I mean, you're absolutely right, Chris. That's probably what happened. You know, just draw these adventurers. And, yeah, it didn't cross anybody's mind, which is part of the problem.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that's telling in and of itself.
Right. So, as Lyle said, showing diversity is the easiest way to be inclusive. And yeah, my feeling is you have to try. And somebody said, oh, we'll, you know, kind of cut them a break. This is the first piece of art we've seen. And I've said, yeah, well, they're already 0-6.
Well, yeah, no, that's a good point, though. What if there are, you know, there's a picture that it's all Asian people?
You know what? That'll be great. And then if I wore a hat, I would eat it. But I don't know.
Yeah, you don't know. But
yeah.
So yeah. Wow, I think people are very, very sensitive.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if it was all black women, I mean, would people complain about that, or people be scared to complain, or I don't know.
They're pretty much screwed either way.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, they could have splashed a little color on that picture, and that's fine. You know, since we're on the issue, it'd be nice if they open up the dwarves and elves and halflings as well to different skin tones.
Mm-hmm. Right. A while back, there was a petition just to say, yeah, do exactly that. Open up the range of skin tones for the demi-humans, because when the first playtest document came out, we had physical descriptions of all the races, and only humans ran from, you know, like pale to ebony. All the other demi-humans had very Caucasian range of skin tones, the descriptor words. And it's like, I don't know, did you even have to say that at all? I mean, a pretty easy solution, in my opinion, would just not mentioned skin color.
Well, when we describe people, we tend to use skin color in addition to hair and stuff. So you would say, oh, their hair ranges from, I don't know, if we're an elf to like silver to blonde.
Well, for hair, they did that, because I remember, I think for 4E, the it wasn't the elves. What was that? The high elves?
Eladrin.
Eladrin, yeah. I mean, they describe them almost in anime kind of styles. Like, their hair can be pink or blue or green, things like that.
I thought there was gnomes, which nobody ever played.
Okay. Sorry, I might have that one wrong, but... I mean, you know, actually, it's something to think about, because we're talking about how WotC is competing hard with Pathfinder to try and get numbers. They're clawing for a market share just against Pathfinder and also against, like, the computer game industry as well. So, you know, maybe that's something that they should be more cognizant of to try and open up their markets. But at the same time, and we know their demographic, it's generally, what, 30 years plus white males. So, I mean, maybe they're just playing to that. Or, again, I honestly don't think they really thought about it. But
right.
Yeah, I don't think they're going, like, let's really focus on the white male. Let's really get more of that market.
Got to nail that one down.
Yeah, I mean, they included women in the picture, so...
And not as eye candy either.
Yeah, so there is a nod there. They're not in the chainmail bikinis and that, so... I don't know. Yeah, I'm of two minds. Part of me says it would be nice if we were at the stage where it doesn't matter.
Right.
Like, if they were all white women or they were all black men or whatever, then it's fine. It's just, what is the picture depicting? I can get past the skin color to see what the characters are and what they're doing and interacting. And on the other hand, it's just easy to draw up a diverse group of people. I mean, you have six to work with and to do that. And the same with the demi-humans. On the one hand, it'd be nice if they just mentioned, just like, oh, you know, the skin ranges from this to this. They could limit it slightly so they aren't as diverse as humans if they would still want to have that, but they could still do it.
Right.
You could say, like, maybe elves can look Asian or white and dwarves could look black or white, but even that is going to bother people.
Right.
If you don't do it as diverse. But on the other hand, it's a game of imagination. So imagine your character's black.
Yeah.
Imagine your character's a woman.
Yeah, you do realize that we kind of have the privilege of being able to say that because they look like us. So it's, yeah, I've heard that before. Like, is it, you're imagining you're a dwarf.
I am not 4 feet tall, thank you.
I know. You're imagining you're a dwarf. Is it really that much of a stretch to imagine that you're a black dwarf? So.
Do not have pointy ears, my friend.
Right.
So. I could grow a beard. I'm a dwarf.
Oh, yeah, you can't grow a beard, can you?
Not really. It takes a couple of weeks for me to just get scruff.
Yeah. I believe he's a gnome, then.
On the plus side, if I forget to shave a day, nobody notices.
Right.
Right. I would welcome the day when we have beardless dwarves to reflect the people that can't grow facial hair. To represent them. Going back to my trip to Canada, I actually got a chance to visit two gaming stores and a comic book store that sold games.
Fine distinction there.
Yeah, it is, because when we get into the episode, it is an important distinction to make when we talk about, like, what's stocked and that.
Right.
So I thought that was good to see, and good to see what was being stocked and who was in the store.
Mm-hmm.
And the store in Toronto, especially, it was called 401 Games. Yeah, it was amazing, like, really cheap prices and that, and they stocked a lot of stuff.
Cool.
And it got me thinking, is like, you know, if I actually lived in Toronto, you know, I would make a special trip to go to the store, and I doubt I'd order as much from, like, online retailers like Amazon. Yeah. So in that, you can see your local gaming store competing with the online retailers if they do certain things. So we got to talking about what makes for a good gaming store and just some things that we've observed recently in gaming stores. So what we're going to do is kind of break down into different categories, such as the layout, display, the stock, the service, pricing, and who was in the store, and talk about what we observed and what we'd like to see.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you two also went to stores. Wayne, you went to one in Los Angeles?
Yeah, that was about a year ago, right before I went to the convention in Los Angeles, yeah.
Yeah, I went to stores, though. One would be a stretch to call it a gaming store, though, even though it billed itself as such, and that was just last month.
I'm curious, what was it? It was a bookstore?
No, what did it call itself? I think it called itself something like Imagination Zone or Mental Zone or something like that. But they had a corner of board games and such. So I tried looking in there for the stuff that the other store lacked, but unfortunately nothing.
Was it in the mall?
It was, yeah. It was.
Oh, okay. Okay.
They sold like puzzles and mind games and tricks, things like that.
Okay.
Right.
But what cities or towns did you go to, Chris?
Mine was in Schaumburg, which is about an hour north of Chicago.
Schaumburg sounds small.
No, well,
it's the Burg of Sean's.
I'm just wondering how a place called Schaumburg can grow.
No, it's a pretty busy, it's just on the outskirts of the city right along the highway, so it's I don't know how many people live there, but it's pretty big as far as, like, business park, and it's got the largest mall in the Northwest area there. So
come to Schaumburg.
Largest mall in the Northwest, yeah.
Yeah.
I have no connection to the place. Feel free.
It's a Schaumburg. Sorry.
Population of 80,000.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I went to stores in Ottawa, which is, for people that don't know, capital of Canada, and a smallish city, and Toronto, which is the biggest city in Canada, for millions of people.
So bigger than Schaumburg, huh?
Who'd have thunk it?
Yeah, and then I think people are familiar with LA. All right, and yeah, so I went to two dedicated game stores and a comic book shop that had games. We have a mall store. And yours, Wayne, was a dedicated gaming store?
Yeah, mine was a dedicated gaming store. And then I forgot, I also went to the comic book slash game store in Philadelphia when I was there too. But I kind of like what Chris was saying. I don't know if I would call that a dedicated game store because it was more a comic book store.
Okay. So what did you guys notice about the layout of these stores or things that stood out?
First thing that came to mind is role-playing games were not prominently displayed. And
very few?
No, they actually had, maybe this kept jumping ahead in stock a little bit, so I won't dwell on it, but they had a lot of role-playing games, but they were just in boxes on tables in the back, and you essentially had to, like, root through them to find what you were looking for, which was fun, and I, you know, find a lot of titles where I'm like, oh, cool, I remember this, or oh, I wanted that, but unless you knew what you were looking for, you wouldn't know what to get at all.
Were there a lot of boxes there?
There were a lot of boxes, and they were divided into, like, you know, the different systems, like this box is GURPS, that box is Hero, that box is, you know, World of Darkness, that box is whatever, and they were labeled, but within the box there wasn't any organization.
That sounds actually pretty sweet, though. Like, it almost sounds like a comic store where you're kind of rifling through the box displays to find something.
It was, yeah, that's a good way to put it. But, as I said, unless you knew what you were going to pick up, or unless you were already familiar with this system, and then were just browsing for stuff that looked interesting or you didn't have, there's no way a new player could get into the hobby that way at all.
Hmm. Yeah, I remember when I went to university going to a game store, which may have been a comic book slash game store, and I did like the boxes, but I liked the boxes for the old, used games that were heavily discounted.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fun to root through there, but you would want the main games or the new games to be displayed.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the store that I went to, it was a proper game store, and in that it had, you know, kind of the dark interior, and there was a bunch of guys sitting around the counter playing cards. They only had one small bookshelf of role-playing games, and it was fairly current. They had a lot of Palladium titles, too, which surprised me. I was the same mind as you guys. If I stop playing a game, I just forget that it exists. But, and yeah, a few D&D adventures and things like that. But there was not much variety, but it was well enough displayed.
Yeah.
The thing that really disappointed me, though, is even though this was a gaming store, it still had far too many of the big games, like the Monopoly, Scrabble, you know, the 10 versions of Monopoly on one wall.
No, they are games.
technically. I suppose I understand, you know, that maybe that's what brings in the money, but still, it sucks to see that much floor space being used for that crap of a game.
You know, it's funny you should say that, because I was thinking about games like Monopoly and Scrabble and where people find them, because a lot of adults aren't necessarily going to go to Toys R Us. And I do realize that a lot of adults do go to Toys R Us to buy toys.
More likely than game stores.
But, yeah, the people who aren't that into games and that, I mean, where do they buy their party games? And it'd be like Walmart, Target, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's actually good that a game store would have more conventional games, because that's very inclusive, and it's just like, you know, any kind of game. If they had poker chips, I think that would be great.
Right.
Yeah, I suppose, but I still don't see people walking in there. Well, somebody's looking for McDonald's, somebody's looking for Monopoly, they would look for the game store first. But
well, I think it depends on where the store is, because going back, the comic book store I went to when I was in Philadelphia was originally a Games Workshop when I was in high school, and they had the big display windows on the front with, you know, awesome setups, and that's what initially drew me in, and then cost me a whole bunch of money over the years that I now wish I had back. But, like, if it's in a spot where it's going to get a lot of walk through or walk by traffic, such as like a mall or like a shopping street, then having those games in the front will draw casual gamers and other people in, because, speaking of Games Workshop, like I worked at a Games Workshop for a summer, and we would get people coming in constantly asking us if we sold video games, because they just saw, we were in a big shopping mall, and they just saw Games Workshop and assumed that we sold video games or Monopoly or other stuff. And being trained as staff, we were told that the thing to say is, no, we don't have those games. The games we do have are these, you know, the kind of the sales pitch. Let me show you the games we do have. And more often than not, they were like, yeah, that's cool. I'm only interested in, you know, Madden 06 or whatever year it was. And they'd walk out.
Oh, you haven't tried Blood Bowl?
Yeah, exactly. Well, we don't have that football video game. We do have these elves and orcs playing football, you know. So most of the time people would walk out, but you know, a couple times you still had to do that sales pitch. So
sometimes they'd back out slowly.
Yeah.
You know, like EB Games, even though I know it's video games, I'll still walk by and glance in to see if it has anything else other than video games.
I know, I do that every time too.
It's like, oh, is there anything I'm... Nope.
Hoping against hope for that one pack of Magic cards or something?
Something, yeah. And again, you stock like regular games in there, like board games and things like that. Yeah, I'm all for that kind of crossover. The Toronto game store, 401 Games, they had a nice display, nice store frontage. It looked very clean.
Mm-hmm.
So very inviting. It looked pretty new. And the role-playing games were near the door on several bookshelves. A lot of spine displays, but with some covers shown.
Right.
So it was close to the door, but then there was also a table where people played. So it was actually a little bit difficult to get to. And in the middle, though, I mean, well, you also go through some of the geek stuff, so like T-shirts and figurines and stuff like that. And then in the middle, just board games upon board games. And all in the back, just loads of board games.
Right.
Awesome.
Like Fantasy Flight games. Yeah, no, it was really good. And Living Card games were there. And then Magic was special place, you know, by the cash, where Magic always is because it's still the big seller.
Right.
And all of the, you know, the singles displayed and that, so...
Hands down, the best gaming store I've ever been to was the Gamers Guild up in Lake Geneva. I think I've mentioned it before. That's where that was the Gygax's shop.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Man, that place was awesome. The original one. Now, I haven't been there in probably 6-7 years, but last time I went, they'd moved to this little tiny shop on the second floor somewhere. It was kind of sad to see. But the original place was this big building, and it had these huge like tree timbers as pillars kind of going all the way down the side. And it was a two-level one. It was a floor level and then the basement level. Actually, it had a upper level, too, where they lived. It was their apartment. But they had all the games and board games on the walls and everything on the upper level. Then you go down to the lower level, and they had all these big oak tables down there that you used for gaming. Every time you went in there, there'd always be tons of people just downstairs playing. Oh, it's a great place.
Oh, that sounds pretty cool. The place I went to in Los Angeles was at least four rooms. Kind of the front where a lot of big box Fantasy Flight games and Magic and the Living Card games were. And then the first room in the back had a big table, and that's where all the role-playing games were. But, I mean, it looks like you could play, like, several games of Magic simultaneously while someone was running, like, a 40K game on another side of part of the table. It was a massive table. And, yeah, a lot of people were sitting around that. And then the miniature war game stuff was another room back.
The Toronto one had a floor, like a basement floor, which was all... gaming tables.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it seemed pretty lively, even like on like a Wednesday.
Mm. Nice.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. That's good to hear.
The gaming store in Ottawa was. You walked in, there was a lot of again toys.
Hmm.
And then the role playing games or the tabletop role playing games were actually pretty. Once you actually went into the store, were pretty prominently displayed in that. Gosh, it's not a. What do you call those bookshelves where everything's displayed all cover up?
Cover up. You mean like.
Cover forward.
Something that can rotate?
No.
It's not the spines. It's where they lay the books flat so you see the cover.
Right. Oh, okay. Kind of like a magazine rack, I'm imagining.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Like a book rack.
Right.
Yeah. So they had that. So that was really good. So you could see the games quite easily.
Hmm.
But the sacrifice there is they didn't have it. They had a lot of board games, but not as many.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously the focus was more on Magic and role-playing games.
Right.
And then they did have, like, living card games and some of the other stuff, but not as much as the Toronto game store.
Hmm.
And HeroClix was huge.
Hmm.
And all in all the stores. There was just a lot of HeroClix.
Really? In all the stores you went to? Because much like Chris and his Palladium comment, I kind of assumed that since I hadn't seen the HeroClix, it just didn't exist anymore.
No, it's come back, and then they were talking about it. Like, one guy came in and bought all of the HeroClix for this one run, or one set, and the guy, he was asking for more or something like that, and the GameStop guy goes, I don't know which ones are going to be a hit, so I've got to put in my order, and it's only when they actually are released, you know, how popular they're going to be. And he said HeroClix is, he said, it's real hit or miss. Some of them, some of the sets really hit, and some of them no one wants to get.
Interesting.
Yeah, but that was a surprise. But when you walk in, it just, you need kind of toy kind of games, you know, because that looks cool.
Well, we were talking about it a few episodes back, just about how important the art is just to catch somebody's interest for it. And yeah, it's a big part of it in the game store as well. I mean, I've never bought the little figurines and characters that go along with games, but unless you count Warhammer. But, you know, those always draw my eye. I always look at them when I go through a store.
Yeah. Well, jumping ahead a bit, because we're going to talk about customers later, but I did actually get to observe somebody who's never played a role-playing game going through, this was in the Toronto store, going through the role-playing games, trying to decide which one to buy. And the one he picked up was Eclipse Phase.
That's the one he picked up first.
Nice.
No, he picked up another one first, and then he picked up Eclipse Phase and thought that was really cool, and was going, oh, that looks really cool, and he's flipping through the book going, oh, this looks really cool. This looks really cool. And all he's doing is looking at his pictures.
Right.
And he even thought it was related to another game. Oh. But then he was like, oh, no, but this looks really cool. And the guy's trying to talk him out of it because it's Eclipse Phase. And he's like, you know, he didn't think it was appropriate for a first-time gamer.
Right.
Which it isn't. It's a bit more advanced.
Yeah.
And the guy's like, oh, well, this looks really cool. And he's like, well, you know, maybe that shouldn't be your first role-playing game. And he's like, oh, but look at this. Yeah, this is what I want. So he actually put it back and did, I think he's doing that. Well, I'll think about it a bit. But, yeah, just what grabs your eye is, like, interesting art, not stunning mechanics.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about catches your eye, how did you find things were displayed? Like the tabletop role playing games were displayed?
Well, for the place I went in Los Angeles, the stuff that was on display was the board games and I guess HeroClix, that kind of stuff too, and Magic, and they just had the shelves kind of along the wall and in the middle of the room. So it wasn't like a tight squeeze to walk around, but you kind of did have to watch yourself a little bit just because, you know, they wanted to put as much stuff on display as possible. But then the boxes were up and you could, you know, obviously pick them up and turn them around and look at them. And we were talking at lunch, and I guess, again, this jumped ahead a little bit, but Lyle, you mentioned at lunch that a box from like a board game, you can actually flip it over to the back and see a little bit of how to play. And so I think that's important for displaying that stuff as opposed to like a book where you have to flip through it and, you know, much like your Eclipse Phase story, you don't really get a sense of how to play unless you actually read the thing, which you tend not to do when you're just looking through it for the first time.
Was I surprised? I don't know. But with the role-playing games, there was a lot of spines facing you in the Toronto store, whereas the board games, of course, would have the fronts facing you.
Right.
So definitely sold the board games. And if they, you know, had some of the sides of the board games, at least a couple would be flipped over. And there was some effort to do that with the tabletop role-playing games, where there would be like, you know, every five or something would be having the cover facing you. But a lot of black spines. If I was going to make a role-playing game, I would not go with a black spine because there were so many. I found Burning Wheel. I knew Wayne was interested in that. And one of the reasons why I was able to find it, because it's a brown book.
Yeah, it's kind of like a
goldish.
So it's
like, what's that brown book? And I'm like, oh, Burning Wheel.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about that until you mentioned it. And it's like, yeah, a lot of books do have that black spine. And so when you're standing there at the shelf, you cannot automatically or quickly visually identify what books are what. I mean, unless they have a really distinctive typeface for what it is. So,
well, one of the reasons why he thought the Eclipse Phase was another game is because it was like black spines of all the Fantasy Flight games, the Warhammer 40K games, running into Shadowrun, running into something else, and then it ran into Eclipse Phase.
Right.
And he just happened to think it was the one before.
Right.
Because he's just seeing identical-looking books if you're just looking at the spine.
Mm. Yeah, and actually the artwork for those are pretty similar, too. Like, yeah. It's almost a continuum.
Yeah, I could see how you'd assume that, yeah.
I was really surprised. They had every one of the Fantasy Flight games both in the Ottawa Game Store and in the Toronto Game Store, those were really heavily represented.
Hmm.
And Dungeons & Dragons even had very, very little shelf space.
I'm not surprised at that.
Fair enough. I mean, it hasn't been around in a while, but just looking at it, and you're thinking, like, even when 5th edition comes out, it's going to take a while for it to start to secure a lot of shelf space, if it ever will. Pathfinder, there was a lot of stuff for Pathfinder, of course.
I wonder if retailers are devoting or ready to devote a lot of shelf space to 5e, D&D 5e, when it comes out. Because, like, even though Pathfinder may be selling better than anything that's currently out for Wizards of the Coast or Dungeons & Dragons, Dungeons & Dragons is still the household name for role-playing games.
Oh, they'll definitely be willing to stock it.
Mm.
I'm just thinking the number of titles that 4E had and the number of titles, of course, there's only going to be like 3 books.
Right.
This year, or 5 books this year or something. That it's just not going to take up very much space unless they order a lot of multiples, which is not what they were doing. They were having the like one copy of each. Obviously, they would take stuff from the back, I would imagine.
Right.
But just looking at the amount of shelf space, Dungeons & Dragons would look like a mighty small game for quite some time. That just kind of surprised me because you're used to D&D taking up a lot of space in the gaming store.
Right.
And it doesn't do that anymore.
The place I remember, it had quite a few D&D books, but they were from various different editions. There were some 4E there, some 3E, so some older stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. The layout's hard to say because, again, I was in a mall shop, so space was very restricted. So there was one wall was the popular games, again, Monopoly, Scrabble. The back wall was all board games, and then the last wall was the register, and then the rest of it was split between role-playing books and like Warhammer tabletop games.
Right.
So those definitely got the least amount of space in the store. Right.
Speculation, but I mean, as you said, Lyle, D&D is going to have only a few titles this year, but I don't know if that would work in their benefit, but it might be easier then to identify what is D&D because you don't have to look all over the place and you possibly won't have prior editions of Dungeons & Dragons kind of cluttering up the same space that they have in 5 editions, or there will be 5 editions, and for a new person entering the hobby, if they just lay out all, if a store just lays out all the D&D stuff in the same area, it could be difficult for a person new to the hobby to know what is the latest edition.
Yep.
Yeah. Though I imagine 5e will probably get front and center, though.
Well, yeah, and it being a small, you know, a small bit could actually be, maybe not a benefit, but easier to identify.
I wonder if that's telling it all to the market of what people buy, because for all of us it seems like the board games got some of the largest area in the stores, but I always got the impression that board gaming was more of a minor hobby compared to role-playing or tabletop war gaming.
Well, anecdotal evidence, especially in the Toronto store, the customers, if they weren't crowded around the magic cards, they were checking out the board games.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Because it's over in here in Japan, there's a Yellow Submarine, which is kind of a chain shop nearby me, and it's all cards. They have these huge display cases full of card games.
Right.
And then they also have board games, but they're on a shelf by the ceiling, and they're all sideways, not face front. So, I mean, it's obvious that cards are the big thing here. But
yeah.
Well, the Yellow Submarine, because there's two of them, right opposite each other in the same neighborhood, close to me. One of them focuses on cards, and the other one kind of focuses a bit more on board games, where and they have a substantial number of them are on a shelf where you can actually pick them up and look at the box without having to get staff to help you. But I think that's the reason why board games would be displayed front and center, because you can pick up a board game, flip it over to the back, and see what you're getting inside the box, and maybe pick up a little bit of how to play, where turning over a book for a role-playing game does not tell you that.
I mean, the books there, you can pick up the book and page through it.
Yeah, but are you really going to stand and read? I mean, like, flipping over...
I spent a lot of my teenage years doing that.
Okay, fair enough. So did I. But, like, someone who's looking to kind of, you know, not spend all day in the game store. I mean, I'm thinking of the StarCraft game that I got off of Lyle. You pick it up, you flip it over, you see what the board looks like, you see what the pieces look like, you see the cards. Maybe you don't know exactly how to play, but you get a pretty good sense of what the game is going to be about and how much space it's going to take up and what you're going to do in it. Where, you know, you flip over the back of a role-playing game and you're told probably about setting or about you know, stories in your imagination, and you're like, that doesn't really tell me all that much about how to play. So
yeah, and also the how to play section is usually like 30 pages long.
Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and even with the card games, because of the living card games, there's so many of them now, like 40K, Lord of the Rings, Call of Cthulhu, blah blah blah. But I know they play slightly differently from Game of Thrones and Netrunner, but I don't know how. Based, you know, just I couldn't go in the store and pick up. They don't call them chapter packs. They all have different battle packs and things like that.
Right, right.
Asylum packs. Yeah, but you can't pick that up and go, okay, now I know how this plays differently from Game of Thrones or Netrunner.
Right.
So, but if I had a board game, I might get a better idea why this board game is a little bit different than the other board game.
Yeah.
And even if you have like some like a display of cards, it always kind of looks the same. It's like cards laying face up on the table. Guy has a hand of other cards. All
right. Okay. Right, right.
Playing like a card game somehow.
Yeah.
How did you find the stock? Because I found the Toronto one was unbelievably stocked. So they had every pack for the living card games. Of course, they were all up to date on Magic. They had a lot of board games, like a lot of them, like ones I'd never even heard of before. And for the tabletop role playing games that they did stock, they tended to stock a lot of it.
So, well, my situation was a little bit different because, as I said, I went right before a convention, and the shop was close enough to the convention hall where they said, we've packed up a lot of the stuff because we're going to be in the dealer room tomorrow. So the more popular stuff they had packed up, I was specifically looking for Netrunner to get into that, and they had all the data packs. They didn't have the core set, so I gambled and bought all the data packs first, hoping I would be able to pick up the core set later, which luckily I was, because it would have been pretty dumb if I hadn't. But so in terms of stock, the role-playing game, the way it was displayed, I have no idea what they had. Because again, you're just kind of like rooting through boxes like old comic book issues. But it seems like popular board games, so they had a pretty decent stock of.
The comic book store is pretty Spartan when it came to the living card games, or even the miniature games. They would have some of them, but not, and only the most recent ones, but not all of them. Not many role-playing games, a selection of board games that they think might sell. Like, they all have the zombicide.
Right, right.
They tended to have, like, a couple zombie board games. Whereas Magic was always stocked completely in all the stores.
Yeah, because, hey, Magic makes money, so why not stock it?
Yep, I didn't see anybody buy any living card games while I was in the stores, except for myself. Everybody, I got to watch people buy Magic cards in all the stores, and people looking at the board games. I didn't see a lot of miniature games in any of the stores, but the Ottawa game store did have miniature games, and one guy bought the latest, I think, Warhammer 40K. You guys were talking about that last episode.
Right.
And was not happy about it. It was like, oh yeah, I guess I gotta buy it, and kind of complaining how they keep coming out with new editions.
I agree.
Yeah.
Right.
But yeah, I'd never seen somebody so joylessly buy a game. Like, and he didn't just buy the one book. He bought like a couple 40K books or something.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that's Games Workshop for you, because you're just buying it, saying, and in 2 years I'm gonna have to buy it again at an inflated rate. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and they've got like the Fantasy Battle. They're all like hardcover books, so they charge what, $50 or something for them.
You know what?
Sorry, they charge $50 for the non-hardcover books too.
That sounds a bit low for a Games Workshop hardcover book.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the place I went to, it had a lot of breadth, but not a depth for it. They had one or two boxes of pretty much everything, but that was it. Just one or two boxes. Mm. I saw Netrunner and I saw the Game of Thrones there. I was actually looking for one for you, Lyle. And they didn't have it in stock.
Got it in Toronto.
So good thing he didn't. They didn't have it. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
No, same but thing, he told me he didn't have it. That's why I got it in Toronto.
Yeah. Lots of different game editions, but not many versions of the books. So I don't know. Yes. But again, space was a big issue there.
Mm.
So
What do you
prefer? And I guess the answer is, well, if they don't have my game, then I prefer blah blah blah. But depth or breadth? Do you prefer a lot of complete selection of a particular game, or them having some of a bunch of different games?
If I was just going to browse, then breadth is better, just kind of see what's out there. But if I'm looking for something, well, then it's the same kind of deal, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, but my answer was pretty much the same. I guess looking at it, the perspective of, you know, attracting new people to the hobby, well, then it's breadth, because you want to show them what options are out there. But then once they're in the hobby, then they're probably going to stick with one game, and so then you need depth. So, I don't know.
But then they're willing probably to special order through you or something like that.
Right. Nah,
or buy it online.
You know, of course, if I went in and they didn't have the game I want, then that would be disappointing. But I would say depth in that for the new player, you want them to buy the games where they can find other players.
Hmm.
And you want them to not buy the Eclipse phase.
Not because it's a bad game.
Yeah, just because you want them to buy a more straightforward game that that they'll be able to find people to explain it to them, and that they'll be able to get their head around very quickly. So, I mean, we know what those games are. So it'd just be good to see, like, oh, and these are all the different books I can get for this game. Ooh, that looks cool. That looks awesome.
Yeah, I suppose it's good from a owner's perspective, too. Somebody walks in with a fat wallet, and they find something they like.
But if you just had, for example, the Rifts, the main Rifts book.
Well, that'll just stay there forever.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but they buy that, and they think, well, I never have to buy another book again.
Right, because I'm done with this role-playing thing.
Yeah. Exactly.
No, I was thinking, like, a character.
Right. Wait, hold on. No, I was thinking that several games recently are going to kind of digest size, especially like the Apocalypse Worlds and Fate, and that could be a way to, not combat, but a way to deal with the space issue, because they don't take up as much space, which means you can stock more of them or more kinds.
They took up as much, when you do spine fronts, they take up as much space, because it doesn't matter how short they are.
Right, I was thinking
based on what I saw, it wasn't a space saver in that regard, but it's easier to carry around, I suppose. And it's funny when you mention Fate, because that's what the guy was trying to get the other guy to buy, the new guy to buy.
I agree with that, yeah.
And he's like, and he's like, no, that's good. He's like, yeah, it just kind of looks boring. Like, he had the new Fate book, and they had, I think, all of the newish Fate books.
Right.
There, and he's like, no, well, that's just like the rules. And he's like, So when we're talking about having a separate rule book based on that one evidence of that one person,
right,
I mean, that doesn't really jump out at them, and they look at it and it looks boring,
right?
And then they buy something that has a setting attached to it, and that looks exciting.
Now that's a really good point, because as much as I kind of like Fate, other people I've talked to, they said it would have been nice to have a set setting for the rule book, so that we could have more detailed examples in it, rather than kind of general examples that apply to everything. And yeah, you telling that story, I mean, the pictures in Fate are decent, and it's an interesting game, but it's not going to grab someone or a new player as strongly as something like Eclipse Phase with its dedicated setting, D&D with its kind of dedicated setting is going to do. So
the thing that attracted me to Fate was the Fate system. But if I was a new gamer and I didn't really understand about systems, then that, whatever, doesn't sound interesting at all.
Oh, yeah, and you got to think that they're flipping through and they're seeing people who are dressed differently or look differently.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, like, hey, these people look like me, showing me the rolling dice, and then there's, like, a cyborg monkey and a fantasy thing and Hong Kong action. What the hell is going on in this book?
Yeah. Now, how did you find the staff and the stores? And the reason why I'm asking this is because a group on Facebook of tabletop role-playing gamers were just not necessarily complaining, but just commenting on the level of service they get in gaming stores, indicating that it was bad. And I didn't find that in the stores that I went. I thought the service was quite good.
I wasn't all that impressed with the service at the place I went to. Maybe a lot of factors going in terms of, like, location, and people only go if they kind of know about the store, but, like, when I went in, pretty much all the staff was in the back room around that gaming table, either playing Magic or kind of reading comic books or doing something, where, like, I actually had to kind of go and get somebody to ring up my NetRinger stuff, and I don't even think the guy who rung me up was an actual employee, just kind of like a friend of the store. And I'm like, so the service wasn't bad, and I didn't really have anything I needed help with. It just didn't strike me as being fantastic.
Well, I don't know. I think that's maybe a more important job for the staff of a gaming store, is to engage and introduce people to the games that are there.
Well, I think that's exactly it. Like, nobody came out and actually kind of talked to me when I walked in. And part of me is glad from that, or part of me is glad about that, because when I go into a store, most of the time I just say, leave me alone and let me look around and find what I want to on my own. And if I have a
Maybe
question, I'll ask you.
They remembered you.
Right. They remember me because I've never been there before. Right. Right.
But just again, leave him alone. Let him pick up the stuff.
Right. So I am in the wrong country, but with the everybody and their mother has to say Irushimase when you walk in the store, even the guy in the back who didn't see you here.
Nah, but Japan's pretty good, I find, because they do the kind of the ritual.
Right.
They welcome you, but they don't necessarily come up and do anything else. Whereas if you go in a store in Canada, and I'm sure it's in the same states, the people come up to help you. Be friendly and try to have a conversation with you.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, because in my time working at Games Workshop, you have quotas to meet, so you better hook those customers, and you know, you got to engage them within about like 15 seconds of them walking in. So,
well, you know, that when that mall I went to, that there used to be a Games Workshop there, and that was great service. You know, I walked in, the guy was friendly. We played a game of Gothic right there before I'd even looked at the stock on the shelves. I know it was all sales pitch, but still, it was fun. I enjoyed the experience.
Hmm. Yeah. And then when you walked out without buying anything, you're like, oh, that was a waste of 10 minutes.
I think I got a tank that time. Oh, so actually, maybe.
So it's like,
he did his job.
The stores I went to, the people were working. So, and I think Magic owed a lot to the staff in two of the stores because, and this gets into something that Wayne and I were talking about, is like how accessible Magic is or how easy it is. And I always thought it would be pretty easy to jump on because the starter sets will be clearly labeled and you know which one is the starter set, but it doesn't seem to be the case anymore. And in one case, the person had played Magic but was out for a while because they knew about Magic, but they were asking about the difference between an intro and an event deck. And you know, there was like actually several. And then in the comic book store, you know, there was like a deck builder set, there was the intro set, the event set, and some other kind of set, and that, and a brand new person who had heard of Magic but never played before, the staff pretty much had to hold their hand and walk them through and you know, quiz them and try to figure out what they would like, and then recommended that, and but they didn't even recommend the intro sets because they said it was too difficult.
Interesting.
So they had to get them something else that was based around blue. And it was like, try it out, see how they feel, and then come back, and then get to know the rules and that. But in both cases, people, without the staff helping them, they wouldn't have known what to buy, and they probably would have walked out without buying anything.
Right, right.
I could see what Magic's doing, and they're releasing something new just last Friday. They released like a new set, but there's like so many different sets to buy that I can see somebody really having a tough time deciding what to buy or deciding what they would need to start.
Like, as you said, we were talking about it, and I guess the benefit that a living card game has over Magic is there is one core set, and you always know what one thing you need to buy to start getting into the hobby. Like, but as you said, with Magic, there's so many different packs now that I hadn't thought about since I'd played for so long, but you bring it up. Like, yeah, a new player trying to get in, they're not going to know what to buy. What's the difference between a starter pack, a tournament pack, an intro pack, a dual pack, and whoever knows however many packs they have?
Yeah.
Kind of that analysis paralysis where there's too much stuff and I don't know what to choose.
Right. That said, if they did actually get the intro packs, and I picked up a couple of those, see what was inside, and you do get a lot of stuff for the price. It was a good value. But yeah, you know, you have to have somebody kind of walk you through to determine what to buy. And the deck builder looked like a pretty good starter, except I wasn't sure if the decks came pre-made, which is what I would think a new player would need, is at least some pre-made decks to start them off, and then they just expand from the rest. So if it was like that, then that would have been great. But that's an aside, but just to say that the staff actually haven't been very, very good. Maybe the fact that they're all staffed by Canadians, it makes a difference or something.
So everything was super polite?
Hello.
And in French.
And the comic book store was staffed primarily by women. We're talking about diversity. Yeah.
I didn't see any women in any of the stores I went to.
I saw... Well, we get into the customers that we saw, which was another item on our list. And I saw no female customers in the Ottawa gaming store, some in the comic book store. and quite a few in the Toronto store. But they seem to be looking through the board games. And not always like with, you know, accompanying a boyfriend. So I actually saw like a couple of women together going through the board games. I didn't not, the only people saw near the role-playing games were men.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I can't really talk much about the customers that I saw because I was the only customer in the store when I was there. So
surly.
Yeah, surly, combative, surly wanted to be left alone, only came for one thing. Yeah.
Yeah, the Toronto store is pretty thriving, actually. Like a lot of and a lot of ages, but I didn't see anybody playing role-playing games. I saw them playing board games and card games in the store. But yeah, you got people in maybe the mid to late teens, I saw. Again, on diversity, a lot of white people. Except around the board games. And Toronto, people you're not familiar with Toronto, is very multicultural. And it definitely has a large Asian community. And yeah, there was a fair amount of Asian customers. So Asian Canadians. Yeah.
That leads back to the, then show them in the games.
Yeah, but you notice they weren't clustered around Shogun. they were fine with any game. I remember one customer really wanted like a food game.
Food game?
Yeah, and it was like, I want a chocolate game, and went up to one of the staff, and he's like, oh, you want, the only two I know of are blah, 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 blah. Like, that was good.
Were either of those the ones that the customer wanted?
No, they wanted a board game about chocolate. They didn't want, oh, there is this board game about chocolate, and I want that. They wanted a board game about chocolate. And they were able to deliver. And I was just, you know, eavesdropping on that going, wow.
Right.
That is impressive.
As would I, because, I mean, I just kind of assumed that the person knew there was a game that had maybe, like, chocolate in the title. But no, it's just like, I like chocolate. I like games. Let's put these two things together. Where is my game about chocolate? Has one been made? So that's a very odd combination, but hey, whatever.
Yeah, my daughter's a little bit grumpy now, so I think I'm going to have to sign off here. So take it away, guys. Sorry.
What is your definition of a little bit?
This isn't too bad yet.
And last, but certainly not least, is the price. And I guess the reason why we're bringing this up is for two reasons. One is that tends to be the main thing that's brought up when we're talking about gaming stores struggling is that they can't compete with Amazon prices. And the other reason is I went to the 401 Games and they had Amazon prices. Like where you're like, well, like doing a double take because I was looking at the big ships for this X-Wing miniatures game.
Right.
And when I looked at the price of one, I thought it was the other, the smaller one because it was
so cheap.
Yeah, so cheap. And I was just like, wow, I did a double take. And then went to get the some chapter packs for Game of Thrones, and then they were very, very cheap. So I actually asked the guy, you know, it's like, okay, how can you afford to sell the things at these prices? And he's like, wow, we got really, really thin margins. He's like, we're making maybe a buck on that chapter pack. And he's like, well, we just rely on volume. And if you, I guess if you're in Toronto and you've got a lot of foot traffic, which they did, then you can rely on volume.
Right.
So I guess that's something, at least for the gaming stores in the big cities.
Well, that's what I was wondering, because the only way to make up for such low margins are a lot of volume. Well, you mentioning price made me think of loyalty, which is what a lot of people think of with game stores, because why would you go to a game store when you can just pay, as you put it, Amazon prices for stuff? And there has to be more than price to keep people coming back. Again, working at Games Workshop, you were, it was sales technique, but you were supposed to interact with the customer and, you know, kind of build up something of a rapport and try and get them to come back, and offering a place to play and events like, right, how to assemble your miniatures or how to paint or, you know, army composition stuff was a way to get them to come back so that they wouldn't just go buy stuff from Amazon or from an online retailer. And you know, I think that's what a game store would have to do, and then people would be willing to pay, or maybe more willing to pay those prices. And a couple of stores I go to here to play card games, the place where you play is free, but I usually pick up something just because I feel, not guilty is perhaps the wrong word, but I want to ensure that they making those places to play free. So
I guess what would ensure my loyalty is price and stock.
Hmm.
Like, if they had what I wanted. And, I mean, if they're going to have pretty good... I suppose you would pay a little bit more if they're offering, like, a place to play and that. You might feel somewhat obligated, but you're not going to pay 25% more or 50% more or whatever.
Right.
So it would have to be pretty competitive, I would think. Like, a lot of people, even if they do what you do and, you know, buy some card sleeves or something for that, I mean, that's still not a lot of money coming in if they're going to, when they go and buy the set for D&D and go onto Amazon. And
right.
Instead of paying $150, they're going to pay $120.
Right.
They'll do that. So, yeah, I mean, if you can, like, definitely go to the razor thin margins. And you might be able to then, if you actually price the core game stuff, is you might be able to price the more, I don't know, esoteric or more unusual things, the more geek things, at normal prices. And I'm thinking of, like, the t-shirts and some of the figurines and, right. and the mugs, you know, made out of superhero heads. Or in the shape of superhero heads.
I like made out of superhero heads.
Right.
I shall drink from my Thor mug.
Yeah. Actually, it's not Thor, just some guy. Some homeless guy I killed. But he had long hair. I called him Thor. Yeah, they might do that. They pick up, you know, at the cheap Dungeons & Dragons core books at your store. A couple booster packs for Magic, and then they're like, you know, I'm going to treat myself and buy that Flash t-shirt for
$20. Right. Well, I was thinking, not that shopping online is difficult, because it certainly isn't, but we've discussed before about how people are willing to buy something or maybe pay a little bit more for ease of accessibility, where I would much rather walk into a gaming store and purchase something there, even if it's a little bit more, then go online, not be able to see the product, and have to wait for shipping. Maybe that's just me being impulsive, but I think, and again, as you said, Lyle, I would not be willing to pay like a huge markup, but I'm willing to pay for a little bit for immediately getting the product. And again, that's not to say that shipping takes months now, but.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's the delay that would get me, but if you see a book in mint condition, I'll say this for, I think all of the stores, the role-playing games were in very, very good condition. And if you can see that they're in, like, really good condition, then that might make me buy it there.
Right.
As opposed to rolling the dice, even though a lot of the stores are pretty, the online stores are good when you say, oh, it came damaged. Then you can send it back, or they just say, keep it, and we'll send you a new one. But still, like, you would get, you know, the condition of the book you're going to get. So,
right,
you know, kind
right.
of peace of mind there. And having a reason to go other than, you know, the latest release of, especially with role-playing games, because if you're following, unless you're following, you're playing a bunch of them, and you probably wouldn't have time to play a bunch of them, they tend not to release product that often. It's not like a card game.
Right.
So there's not a lot. I mean, you don't have reason to constantly go to the store. So if you gave the customers a reason to constantly go, perhaps frequent game nights and things like that, or events, then that would help.
Well, I know we were talking about the game store, but going all the way back to Wizards of the Coast and Dungeons & Dragons, that's kind of what Dungeons & Dragons seems, or at least Wizards of the Coast seems to be doing with their, you know, Wednesday night encounters, Friday night delves, and whatever. It's... Yeah, you don't have a game group. This your store is participating in this program. You can go and play at the store. And it's kind of turning the store into a little bit of a community. So I think that's a pretty decent thing to do. And if I was running a store, which I'm obviously not, I would try and get in on that program just because hopefully it would encourage people to come back week after week.
All right, so that wraps up our episode on gaming stores and what we observed and what we'd like to see more of. Chris had to go due to
a little bit of a temper tantrum. And
Yeah, Chris is pretty bad on them. He wanted to say something about online stores, so I guess he'll do that in the next episode.
So despite him being away from the computer currently, he'll be the one who does the outro as usual, now that we've recorded it.
Oh, the perfect crime. Revealing it.
All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, outofredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher, or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can plus one us on G+, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in our forums. Those are at idleredhands.com/forums, and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or you can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Drive-through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-through RPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.